And on this Friday, April 12th, Judith and I would like to wish a happy birthday to three of our IRIS listeners. Happy birthday to Evelyn Buffington of Mason City, Maggie Arthur of Spirit Lake, and Janice Day of Eldridge. Again, happy birthday to Evelyn Buffington of Mason City, Maggie Arthur of Spirit Lake, and Janice Day of Eldridge. And we have some celebrity birthdays to read to you today from the Des Moines Register. Jazz musician Herbie Hancock is 84. Musician John Kay, the lead singer with Steppenwolf, Born to be Wild and Magic Carpet Ride, he turned 80. Actor Ed O'Neill of Married with Children turned 78. Late night TV host David Letterman is 77. Actor Andy Garcia, 68. Actress Shannon Doherty turns 53. Actress Claire Danes, 45. And politician Tulsi Gabbard turns 43 today. So happy birthday to all those celebrities as well. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not yet a registered IRIS listener, registered IRIS user, please give us a call here at the office, 515-243-6833, so we can get you on our list. 515-243-6833. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. Now we'll turn it back over to Judith for a look at today's obituaries from the Des Moines Register.
Thank you, Dave. There are six obituaries today. Irene Madge Knapp from Urbandale, a lifelong resident of Des Moines, passed away peacefully in her Urbandale home on April 9. She is survived by her daughter, Jenny, her granddaughters, Kendi, Sable, her grandson, Co, and great-granddaughter, Brooke, and sister-in-law Carolyn, and many nieces, nephews, and their children. Irene was preceded in death by her son Roger, her parents, and her sisters. Irene was born on January 21, 1927, at her grandmother's farm home south of Woodland, Iowa, in Decatur County. She graduated from Allerton High School in May of 1945, was the youngest of three sisters. During high school, she met Bill Knapp, who later she would marry and have two children with. Irene and Bill dated while Bill enlisted in World War II. After returning from war, they married in November of 1946 and soon opened the I&B Cafe in Allerton, Iowa. Looking forward, they sold the restaurant and moved to Des Moines, where they purchased a real estate company that is known in the modern day as Iowa Realty. Irene worked along Bill and managed the books for Iowa Realty. She was committed to living a happy life. Her family knew her for saying, "Let's be happy." Irene had the biggest heart and loved animals. As life proceeded, her passions became Drake University's men and women's tennis and basketball. She was a 50-year-plus member of Westminster Presbyterian Church, where her faith remained an utmost importance to her. She loved supporting the Des Moines Christian School, where the choir would come to sing to her on her porch outside her Urbandale home. Irene's celebration of life will be held Monday, April 15th at Westminster Presbyterian Church on Beaver Avenue. Visitation will be at 1 o'clock, before the service at 2 o'clock, with reception to follow at the church. A private burial will be held at Rest Haven Cemetery. Memorial contributions can be made to Drake University Tennis Program, Westminster Presbyterian, or Des Moines Christian School. Beverly Jean Plude Simpson of Des Moines died peacefully at Taylor House on April 7 after a short illness. She was born on March 2, 1928, the third of five children of Lewis and Myrtle Randolph Plude. She graduated from East Des Moines High School in January. It was at East where she met the love of her life, Richard Simpson. They were married on May 31st in 1946, blessed with four daughters. They enjoyed 68 years of marriage before Dick's death in 2015. Beth was employed by UPS in the personnel department, where she met many lifelong friends. She was a member of Simpson United Methodist Church for 66 years, and also attended Union Park United Methodist Church with friends from Rose Glen. The family will greet friends on Friday, April 12, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Hamilton's Funeral Home, 605 Lyon Street in Des Moines. A funeral service will be held on Saturday, April 13, at 10:30 a.m. at Simpson United Methodist Church, 2600 Capitol Avenue in Des Moines. Interment of Bev and Dick's cremains will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter at a later date. Memorial contributions may be directed to Taylor House Unity Point Hospice in loving memory of Bev. Robert E. Endersby of Lakeville, age 88, passed away peacefully with his family present on April 7, preceded in death by his wife Lois and daughter Mary and siblings. He is survived by his sons Tom, Mick, and Scott, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, also by other loving family and many friends. Funeral service, 11 a.m. Friday, April 19, at White Funeral Home. That's 20134 Kenwood Trail in Lakeville. Memorial visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service. Roger D. Pasek of Ripley, Oklahoma, 82, was called home to heaven on March 2nd at Legacy Village of Stillwater after a long battle with primary progressive aphasia. There will be a memorial service on April 13, 11 a.m. at Bondurant Federated Church. Roger was born to Arlo and Jenny Pasek on April 11, 1941. He is survived by his loving wife, Carol Pasek, his children, Kim, Wes, Janelle, and grandchildren, Jonathan, Alicia, Jessica, Heather, Alan, Lily, and Virginia, and great-grandchildren, Lynn, Savannah, Cheyenne, Mavis, and Elijah. Roger was preceded in death by his parents, and the family would like to thank Carmen Legacy Hospice and Roger's care team at Legacy Village for their compassion and support. And just a short one here, Robert White of Altoona. Services for Robert will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13, at Peterson Funeral Home in Carlisle. And Roberta Pyle of Des Moines departed this life peacefully on Monday, April 8, at Wesley on Grand in Des Moines. A visitation will be held at Isles Funeral Home, Westover Chapel in Des Moines on Sunday, April 14, from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock, with a program at 4:30 p.m. A funeral mass will be held on Monday, April 15, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church at 10 o'clock a.m. with lunch to follow. A private burial service is planned for a later date. Roberta was born December 13, 1928 in Neola, Iowa, to Joseph and Veronica Canale. Her parents chose Neola in which to raise their children because it offered a Catholic school. Roberta graduated from St. Joseph High School and then attended Ottumwa Heights College. Her first job was with Mutual Benefit in Omaha. While there on a blind date, Roberta met Neil Pyle, the love of her life. When a great-granddaughter recently asked her the age she desired to relive, Roberta responded, 21 years old, when I was newly married to Neil. Together they raised six children in the Beaverdale neighborhood. She was a woman of unwavering faith, and while following his teaching, she shared her religion with her family because she desired this same path in life for them. They provided both guidance and comfort in her life and theirs. Her rosary beads were always close at hand. Her garden provided flowers for her May altar, and her children will remember her favorite saying in times of turmoil, "Offer it up."
And we'll continue now with some national news. This page, this story from page 7A of the Des Moines Register this morning. House GOP in turmoil after vote fails. A move follows a call from Trump to kill FISA. This story by the USA Today, Dateline, Washington. Just days after returning from a two-week recess, right-wing fury spurred on by former President Donald Trump brought the U.S. House to a standstill. In a significant blow to House Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Louisiana, as he grapples with a threat to his leadership post. 19 House Republicans shot down a procedural step known as a rule vote in the House on a controversial spying law that has renewed GOP infighting. The move effectively froze the House and left the legislation in a state of limbo. In the days leading up to the vote, House Republicans were confident they could take the lead on renewal of the Foreign Surveillance Authority Act, or FISA, and pass it this week. But it quickly became apparent that several conservative hardliners, furious at Speaker Johnson and accusing leaders of leaving their voices out, were angling to shut down the bill. It also didn't help that Trump, early on Wednesday morning, told Republicans to kill FISA in an 11th-hour post on his social media outlet, emboldening conservative opposition to Johnson's reapproval plan. All of this was happening as conservative agitator Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, dangles a motion to vacate over Johnson's head, vacate the speaker's position. It's an effort that, if passed, would boot him from the speakership. Greene's move, alongside the open rebellion in the House vote, underscores the growing frustration at Johnson from conservatives who say the speaker isn't fighting hard enough for them. One of the conservatives who derailed FISA, Representative Andy Ogles, a Republican from Tennessee, told USA Today that frustration within the hard right ranks has reached a point that it's not clear Johnson would survive an effort to oust him, calling the House fickle. Shortly after conservatives tanked the rule vote, Republican leaders called a snap meeting among GOP lawmakers to discuss the path forward. But members leaving the impromptu Republican caucus meeting didn't describe it as productive. Representative Max Miller, a Republican from Ohio, left the meeting early and said there was zero progress on renewing FISA. The forum quickly devolved into members yelling at each other and blaming other lawmakers for the dysfunction, Miller, visibly frustrated, said. He said, "If anyone says that there's a path forward on FISA right now, they're lying." Miller said that Speaker Johnson literally has to pull a rabbit out of a magic hat for this thing to work at this point. During the meeting's open mic session, some members called to punish the conservative rabble-rousers for tanking the rule vote. Most lawmakers leaving the intense meeting described it as a venting session, which GOP conference meetings have often become in recent months. Representative Mario Diaz-Balart, a Republican from Florida, said, "I'm getting deja vu of the deja vus." All of the chaos is against the backdrop of Greene's efforts to oust Johnson, which she launched last month after the speaker worked with Democrats to avoid a government shutdown. The Georgia Republican met with Johnson for more than an hour on Wednesday, but leaving the speaker's office, she said Johnson simply offered a lot of excuses. Greene said, "He's not done the job that we elected him to do, and I told him that. I said, none of this is changing. Only his actions alone, are the only thing that can sway me." FISA reauthorization may have a clearer path to approval in the Senate, where leaders on both sides agree on the need to extend the spying law, and ultra-conservative senators don't have the same power to derail proceedings. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, said on the Senate floor Wednesday that Congress must ensure FISA authorities are renewed during this work period. Congress takes another break after next week, leaving only 7 days to pass the bill before an April 19th deadline. Republican Whip Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, told USA Today that the Senate will be exploring options to lead on the reauthorization bill given the holdup across the aisle in the House, across the rotunda in the House. Republican Representative Thomas Massie from Kentucky said House lawmakers during the impromptu GOP meeting on Wednesday raised the boogeyman of getting jammed by the Senate if they don't handle the spying bill first in the lower chamber. He said, "And then somebody suggested that we should just let them struggle with it and send it to us." If that happens, there would be a similar debate on the Senate side over what actually goes in the legislation, although the final result likely would not include the reforms some House lawmakers want because of the general consensus in the Senate. However, that attitude is not unanimous. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, the leader of the GOP Senate Steering Committee, the upper chamber's equivalent to the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus, told USA Today he would oppose renewing the FISA legislation without an amendment to require intelligence officials to get a warrant before accessing Americans' data, a provision that has become a major source of contention in the House. Senator J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio, said the surveillance law is in need of serious reform. Vance said, "I'm glad it went down in the House today because I think it gives us an opportunity to force some of those reforms." Trump's foray into the debate on Wednesday appeared to be the final nail in the coffin for House GOP leaders' FISA plans. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, a vocal supporter of changing the legislation, told reporters on Wednesday morning that the former president was right and his comments helped their cause. Speaker Johnson this week said he intends to speak with the former president on the issue soon and defended his plan, arguing the currently effort to renew FISA. That's not right. Let me try and figure out what they're trying to say here. Johnson this week said he intends to speak with the former president on the issue soon and defended his plan, arguing the current effort to renew FISA already includes swaths of reforms and gives the law real teeth to address abuses.
Virginia boy who shot teacher had history of violence. This story by Steve Gorman from Reuters. A 6-year-old boy who shot and wounded his teacher last year in Virginia had a history of violent outbursts in school, including the choking of another teacher that led to his expulsion from kindergarten, according to an investigative report released on Wednesday. The boy's record of disruptive behavior and physical abuse of fellow students and staff at Richneck Elementary School in Newport News, Virginia, were documented in the 30-page report from a special grand jury ordered by the city's chief prosecutor. The report also cited what it said were numerous failures by school administrators, especially Richneck's former assistant principal, Ebony Parker, to effectively address the child's disciplinary problems or keep his classmates' parents informed. The 11-member panel said shocking lapses of judgment and inaction by Parker, who resigned after the shooting, constituted criminal liability for the circumstances that led to the gun violence. An indictment returned by the grand jury charged Parker with 8 counts of felony child neglect, one for every bullet contained in the handgun he brought to school from home in a backpack and used to shoot first-grade teacher Abigail Zwirner on January 6, 2023. The charges, punishable by up to 5 years in prison on each count, if Parker were convicted, were unsealed on Tuesday in a case that has drawn national attention due to the shooter's age. Few, if any, school administrators are known to have been criminally prosecuted over gun violence in schools. The grand jury found that Parker had neglected to take action on 4 occasions when students and staff had warned that, on the day of the shooting, the boy was believed to have carried a firearm to school. She declined at one point to allow his backpack to be searched, the report said. Parker could not immediately be reached for comment on Wednesday, but according to the Washington Post, her lawyer has denied the allegations in Zwirner's civil complaint. The grand jury faulted school administrators generally for several missed opportunities and baffling decisions in failing to provide the boy greater support services available for children with behavior and emotional disturbances. In one instance, during kindergarten, about 15 months before the shooting, the boy had walked up behind his teacher and clamped his arms around her neck, choking her until a teacher's assistant managed to break his grip, the report said. The boy was later expelled, but allowed to return the following academic year at Richneck, where his pattern of disruptive and violent behavior continued, the report said. One parent testified her son had been choked twice by the same boy, but was never told he had a history of similar aggression. The report also cited numerous security lapses it said could have resulted in worse bloodshed had the boy's gun not jammed after the first shot.
NFL superstar and acquitted murderer suspect O.J. Simpson dies at 76. This story by the USA Today. O.J. Simpson, the football star and actor whose life took a shocking turn when he was charged with stabbing to death his ex-wife and her friend, died on Wednesday of prostate cancer at the age of 76, according to a post on social media attributed to the Simpson family. The post said, "Our father, Orenthal James Simpson, succumbed to his battle with cancer. He was surrounded by his children and grandchildren. During this time of transition, his family asked that you please respect their wishes for privacy and grace." Simpson was acquitted of two counts of murder during a televised trial that gripped America and divided the country largely along racial lines. But the jury in a civil trial found Simpson liable for the double murder, and he later served 9 years in prison for his role in a botched armed robbery. He was granted parole in 2017. It completed a stunning fall from grace for the once-celebrated running back who won the Heisman Trophy in 1968 while starring at the University of Southern California. At times, he looked unstoppable in the NFL, too, as a member of the Buffalo Bills, who was inducted into both the College Football Hall of Fame and the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Simpson capitalized on his athletic success in Hollywood, developing a career as a successful actor and TV pitchman. But it all came crashing down after the murder charges that riveted America. There was the televised low-speed car chase in 1994 with Simpson in his white Ford Bronco and police in pursuit as Los Angeles residents cheered from freeway overpasses. Then there was the so-called trial of the century in 1995 when a host of high-powered figures emerged, including Johnny Cochran, one of Simpson's defense attorneys. He turned a bloody glove found at the scene of the crime into one of the most memorable moments of the trial, saying, as Simpson struggled to put his hand into the glove, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." Simpson's acquittal set off celebrations from those who pointed to historically unjust treatment of black people by the U.S. justice system, but dismay from those who argued that, regardless of race, the system favored those who could afford high-priced lawyers. The son of Eunice and Jimmy Lee Simpson, Orenthal James Simpson was born July 9, 1947 in San Francisco and was known as O.J. from birth. Saddled with poor grades, the Galeo High School football star enrolled at City College of San Francisco, where he was named to the Junior College All-America team. After transferring to the University of Southern California, he led the nation in rushing during the 1967 and 1968 seasons. The Pro Football Hall of Fame president Jim Porter, in a statement yesterday, said O.J. Simpson was the first player to reach a rushing mark many thought could not be attained in a 14-game season when he topped 2,000 yards. His on-field contributions will be preserved in the Hall's archives in Canton, Ohio. The end of Simpson's football career marked the start of his celebrity as a broadcaster and actor.
Russian airstrikes destroy power plant close to Kiev. Kiev, Ukraine. This story by Tom Balmforth from Reuters. Russian missiles and drones destroyed a large electricity plant near Kiev and hit power facilities in several regions of Ukraine on Thursday, officials said, ramping up pressure on the embattled energy system as Kiev runs low on air defenses. The major attack, more than 2 years since Russia's full-scale invasion, completely destroyed the Tripolska coal-powered thermal power plant near the capital, a senior official at the company that runs the facility told Reuters. Footage shared on social media showed a fire raging at the large Soviet-era facility and black smoke belching from it. Reuters was able to confirm the location of the video as the Tripolska station. President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Telegram, condemning the acts as terror, "We need air defense and other defense support, not eye closing and long discussions." The Russian Defense Ministry said it hit fuel and energy facilities in Ukraine in what it described as a massive retaliatory strike using drones and high-precision long-range weapons from air and sea. The strikes were a response to Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia's oil, gas, and energy facilities, it said. Kiev's appeals for urgent air defense supplies from the West have grown increasingly desperate since Russia renewed its long-range aerial assaults on the Ukrainian energy system last month. The attacks, which hammered thermal and hydroelectric power plants, have caused fears about the resilience of an energy system that was hobbled by a Russian air campaign in the war's first winter. Ukraine's Air Force commander said air defenses took down 18 of the incoming missiles and 39 drones. The attack used 82 missiles and drones in total, the military said. The destroyed power plant outside Kiev, a major power supplier for the capital and Cherkasy and Zhytomyr regions, is the third and last facility owned by state-owned energy company Centrenergo. Everything is destroyed, Andriy Goda, head of the supervisory board of the company, said when asked about the situation at Centrenergo. The Prilska plant was the biggest energy facility near Kiev and was built to have a capacity of 1,800 megawatt hours, more than the pre-war needs of Ukraine's biggest city. Ukrenergo grid operator said its substations and power-generating facilities had been damaged in attacks on the regions of Odessa, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, Lviv, and Kiev. Ukraine's largest private electricity company, DTEC, which lost 80% of its generating capacity in attacks on March 22nd and March 29th, said Russia's attacks hit two of its power stations, inflicting serious damage. On Thursday afternoon, Russian forces attacked a thermal power station in the Sumy region in northern Ukraine with guided bombs. The scale of damage was not immediately clear, though the regional administration said there were no casualties. The strikes also attacked two underground storage facilities where Ukraine stores natural gas, including some owned by foreign companies. Energy company Naftogaz said the facilities continued to operate, it added.
And we'll take a quick flying tour around the border states of Iowa from the 50-state roundup in USA Today. In Peoria, Illinois, the Illinois Department of Public Health has issued a warning after two people were hospitalized with botulism-like symptoms following cosmetic treatments. Topeka, Kansas. After years of legislative work and an executive order, Kansas will soon have a permanent child advocates office. Up in St. Paul, Minnesota, the presidential election isn't going to be the only tight race that Minnesotans will cast their ballot for in November. All of Minnesota's 8 seats for U.S. House of Representatives and 1 Senate seat are up for grabs, some of which are expected to be extremely competitive. In Kansas City, Missouri, a goat in Kansas City that was rescued after it's made its way to the ledge of a bridge almost 80 feet in the air is bouncing back like a champ. Over in Lincoln, Nebraska, legislation aiming to restrict Nebraska K-12 students from playing on sports teams or using bathrooms based on their sex at birth was narrowly blocked last week after two Republican state senators did not vote, arguing that it would overlap with a current policy in place and could even bar parents from taking their young kids into public restrooms at sporting events. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the Sioux Falls School District and the Sioux Falls Health Department are teaming up to fight the nationwide trend of vaping among youth. And in Madison, Wisconsin, Democratic Governor Tony Evers has signed the PRINCE Act into law, which expands the state's missing persons alerts for children after the homicides of 5-year-old Prince McCree of Milwaukee and 10-year-old Lily Peters of Chippewa Falls exposed holes in the alert system. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Judith Linden and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure to read for you today. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get in place. Enjoy the warm, windy weather. Have a good weekend.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman and myself, Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Now here's Jim with our next article.
Thanks, Scott. And we're on the opinion page of USA Today to begin with here this morning. And I'm going to start with an opinion written by Randy Essex of the Detroit Free Press. Keep your Little Caesars pizza out of my home run celebrations. Part of the magic of opening day is that everything is fresh again. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing birds is come, as Ernie Harwell reminded Detroit Tiger fans each year. We have renewed hope for the team and new players to cheer for. At Co-America Park this year, we have a new giant video board and, as always, some new concessions. I'm a little uneasy, though, about one new feature this season, the Little Caesars pizza that's topped with a can of worms. I feel the Tigers' 2024 home run celebration has the potential to show us what happens when fun collides with the corporate drive to sponsor absolute everything. Let me explain. During the pandemic abbreviated season of 2020, when Major League Baseball teams played 60 games in stadiums with no fans, players on a few teams started celebrating home runs in their dugouts using props, most notably old odd hats. It works like this. A guy hits a home run, circles the bases, and puts on the hat or grabs whatever prop the team uses as he comes back into the dugout. He walks the length of the dugout, high-fiving his teammates. Last year, the Tigers celebrated with a Red Wings helmet and a hockey stick. A guy hit a homer, put on the hockey helmet, carried the stick the length of the dugout, and then pantomimed taking a hockey shot. This year, they tout another Illich Enterprise with pizza on a stick. By May 2023, according to The Athletic, the celebrations had spread to 16 of Major League Baseball's 30 teams, with hijinks of varying complexity. Last year, the Los Angeles Angels' Japanese superstar Shohei Ohtani played for the Angels until this year, used a samurai helmet that costs $2,500. At the other end of the spectrum, the Milwaukee Brewers got a $25 cheesehead from some Packers fans and called it good. These celebrations originated with players and spread from team to team. It's fun and organic. As Pittsburgh Pirates outfielder Andrew McCutchen said, "It is very dumb, but it is hilarious." Earlier that day, McCutchen had donned a black suit jacket and grabbed a rubber sword to enjoy his home run. This goofiness is a reminder that these players are young guys who may lack great taste in pizza, but play a game for a living. Seeing them cut up makes them less aloof, more human. And unlike almost everything else in pro sports, these celebrations have nothing to do with league guidelines. Well, almost. The Atlanta Braves used a funny, oversized baseball cap for a little bit last year, and Major League Baseball made them stop. New Era, the official supplier of Major League Baseball hats, objected because the giant lid wasn't one of theirs. As the Sporting News wrote, it messed with the money. This is the stuff fans hate. We love our sports, our teams, and our players. But the big egos, the big money, and the big foot of league policies can steal some of the fun. And that's why I'm troubled by the implications of the Tigers' new celebration. This year, we are told, the Cats decided to mimic the Little Caesars mascot, the dude in an orange toga holding a spear poked through a pizza. When a Tiger homers this year, he grabs a fake spear carrying three fake pizzas. First baseman Spencer Torkelson is credited with creating last year's hockey celebration. As the Tigers' home run leader last year, he reportedly was tasked with coming up with a new one. "Just had to mix it up," he told the Free Press. "We loved the Red Wings' Selly last year. It's not dead. It can still come out. But our owner owns Little Caesar's Pizza, so we're going to give them some love, too. It's great pizza." Okay, I absolutely believe that guys sitting around in the clubhouse said, "You know, the Angels spent $2,500 on that samurai hat, but there's nothing we love more than pushing that amazing pizza our owner's family peddles for $5. Whatever the origin, my fear is that owners and league officials hear cash registers ringing. It's a real home run sponsorship opportunity. Imagine the Cleveland Guardians home run celebration brought to you by Rocket Mortgage home run hitters pop a foam house over their uni and dance through the dugout. Boise's minor league team obviously needs the Idaho Potato Commission or Hasbro to sponsor a homer hat. Imagine that Bell Tire home run belt. Can't wait to see the Figer Law seventh inning homer hat. At least all they do is win. Overt corporate interference risks turning something that was unexpected fun into more of the corporate pablum that already covers nearly every inch of sports arenas. I'm there for the sports, and the damn logos increasingly get in the way. One last thought. If we're going to have Little Caesar's Pizza in the dugout, could we get some quality slices in the stands, maybe like those served at Mike's Pizza Bar in Little Caesar's Arena? If we can, I promise to wear the red Old English D hat I bought some years ago when the Wings made a Stanley Cup run."
Thank you, Jim. Our other opinion piece is written by Ingrid Jacques, and it's entitled "Civil War Movie Lands at a Scary Time in U.S." The new movie, Civil War, hits theaters across the country Friday, and I'm guessing it's one people will want to see. It plays into troubling themes many of us are thinking about as we head into a contentious rematch between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. A contest between two unpopular figures who many Americans said they didn't want to lead the country for the next 4 years. Starring Kirsten Dunst, who plays a journalist, and Nick Offerman as the President of the United States, the film depicts a time in the not-so-distant future when the president is an authoritarian in his third term. The country is extremely divided, volatile, and at war with itself. The political leanings of the factions at play aren't made obvious, but the allusions seem clear given that this is an offering from uber-liberal Hollywood just months ahead of a pivotal presidential election. Biden and the left are already playing up the theme that this is an election about democracy and that Trump would be the greatest threat ever to our republic. Regardless of your political views, however, the movie is worth thinking about. What it says about our polarization and contempt for the other side is extremely relevant. That seems to be a big point Civil War writer and director Alex Garland wanted to make. "I have a political position and I have good friends on the other side of that political divide," he said at a South by Southwest film and TV panel earlier this year. "Honestly, I'm not trying to be cute. What's so hard about that? Why are we shutting conversations down? Left and right are ideological arguments about how to run a state. That's all they are. You try one, and if that doesn't work out, you vote it out and you try again a different way. That's a process, but we made it into good and bad." Garland goes on to say this way of conflating politics with morality is incredibly dangerous. He's right. That way of thinking means that if you disagree with someone, you not only think that person's ideas are bad, you think the individual is too. These divisions have led citizens to doubt the future of our system of government. In March, a Grinnell College national poll found 25% of respondents believe American democracy will come to an end during their lifetime. That seems a shockingly high number, yet it tracks with other surveys in recent years. A 2022 poll from YouGov and The Economist found that more than 40% of Americans believe that a civil war in the United States is likely or somewhat likely in the next decade. That number goes up to 54% for self-described strong Republicans. Nearly one in four Americans support their state seceding from the United States, with residents in Alaska, California, and Texas most open to the idea. Where will all this division and uncertainty about our country's future lead? While there is no imminent threat of armies clashing on the battlefield, increasing hyperbolic insurrectionist sentiment is a product of a growing realization that the U.S. is now more divided along ideological and political lines than at any time since the 1850s. Bruce Stokes, an associate fellow with Chatham House, recently wrote, "An increasingly balkanized U.S. is likely to be even more inward-looking, preoccupied with internal divisions over immigration, race, inequality, and sexual and gender identity issues." Another alarming trend is that Americans seem to think that only their candidate can hold the torch of our democracy, a simplified term for our constitutional republic, but the one that's most commonly used. A poll from Canada's Angus Reid Institute this year found that large majorities of both Trump and Biden voters are worried about the country's democracy if the other side wins. And only 32% of voters say they'll fully accept the results of the 2024 election, regardless of who wins. Both Republicans and Democrats say they fear a move toward authoritarianism, but they fear it only if their party isn't in charge. A recent Associated Press headline put it this way: "Americans think a president's power should be checked unless their side wins," APNORC poll finds. The poll found that overall, only about 2 in 10 Americans say it would be a good thing for the next president to unilaterally change policy, but that changes drastically when political party is considered. Nearly 60% of Republicans support such executive power if Trump is elected. 40% of Democrats say the same if Biden gets a second term. And both Biden and Trump have shown they are all too comfortable with taking on the mantle of executive power when it suits them. Unchecked, power is not okay just because you may agree with the policies of the person in power. Our system of checks and balances, as laid out in the Constitution, is meant to preserve limits on all branches of government. Deep distrust of the other side and too much trust in our own is an explosive combination. Maybe the Civil War movie is on to something. And again, that was written by Ingrid Jacques, who is a columnist at USA Today.
Thanks, Scott. And we turn our attention to sports from the Des Moines Register. We see the schedule of sports on TV. We have hockey on the NHL Network at 7 o'clock tonight, Carolina at St. Louis. In basketball, the NBA is still going, and we have at 7 o'clock on the NBA T Network, Milwaukee at Oklahoma City at 9:30. On the same network, Phoenix at Sacramento. Major League Baseball, there are several offerings. 6:05 this evening, Apple TV Plus, Milwaukee at Baltimore. At 6:10, Major League Baseball Network, New York Yankees at Cleveland, ESPN Plus, LA Angels at Boston. At 7:10 on Major League Baseball Network, Texas at Houston. At 8:40, Apple TV Plus has the Cubs at Seattle, and Major League Baseball Network, St. Louis at Arizona. At 9:10, Major League Baseball Network has San Diego at the LA Dodgers. And in golf, the Masters from 2 to 6:30 today on ESPN, the second round live coverage is being played at 7 to 11. They do a replay on ESPN. And then from 10:35 to 10:50, CBS does a second round highlights. Then we have Register Athletes of the Week. Dowling girls, Dowling Catholic girls track and field athlete Ruby Lehman and Ankeny boys track and field athlete Tyler Sickerson were voted the Register's Iowa Ortho Female and Male Athlete of the Week winners for the week of April 1st to 7. Lehman won Female Athlete of the Week with 82% of the vote. Panorama girls track and field athlete Jaden Sellers took second with 8%. Lehman turned in the best outdoor long jump effort in Iowa high school girls track and field thus far, according to Varsity Bound at the Valley Relays Saturday in West Des Moines. Lehman won the event with a jump of 18 feet 1 inch. She took first by 6 inches over the 17-7 jump by Des Moines East Kaya James. Sickerson won Male Athlete of the Week with 28% of the vote. Underwood boys soccer player Caden Ogle came in a close second with 24%. Sickerson ran the fastest 100-meter dash time for boys track in the state, according to Varsity Bound, during the Southeast Polk Invitational on April 4th. Sickerson won the 100 at Southeast Polk with a time of 10.55 seconds.
That's pretty fast. Olympian Jones to return to the Drake Relays, written by Tommy Birch of the Des Moines Register. The plan was already for Lolo Jones to be back in Des Moines at the Drake Relays later this year to be inducted into the event's Hall of Fame during a luncheon. Turns out, that'll just be the opening act. Jones, a Des Moines native and once one of a track and field's biggest names, plans to compete in this year's Drake Relays at the school's famed Blue Oval, the runner announced on her Instagram account. She'll compete in the 100-meter hurdles on April the 27th. The race is scheduled to take place around 3 p.m. and televised nationally on CBS Sports Network. The Drake Relays is near and dear to Lolo, said Drake Relays director Blake Bolden. It's always on her radar, and of course, since the day she graduated high school, there's always been a lane for Lolo Jones at the Drake Relays. It's a big return to the famed track for Jones, who was a star runner at Des Moines Roosevelt High School and LSU before embarking on a professional career. Jones, age 41, was the first four-time winner in the Drake Relays Invitational 100-meter hurdles, capturing titles from 2005 through 2008. She was named the Outstanding Women's Performer of the event in 2008 after setting a meet record of 12.74 seconds. She led in the finals in the 100 hurdles at Beijing Olympics before clipping the ninth hurdle and finishing seventh. She later went on to finish fourth in the 2012 Summer Olympics. The Iowa native has become more than just a track star over the years. She competed on the U.S. bobsled team in the 2014 Olympics and won a gold medal in the mixed team event at the 2013 World Championships. Jones has also been a reality television star, appearing on Big Brother and The Challenge.
And we have an update on the Indiana Fever, and their expected number one pick, Caitlin Clark. WNBA is counting on Clark bump as Fever get most national TV games. This written by Chloe Peterson of the Indianapolis Star. The Indiana Fever will be the most televised team in the WNBA this season, the league announced Wednesday. The Fever will have 36 of its 40 games featured on national television through the WNBA broadcast or streaming partners. 8 of those games will air on ABC, ESPN, or ESPN2, while other games will be on ION, NBA TV, Prime Video, and the CBS Sports Television Network. Indiana's 36 appearances on these platforms are the most in the league, beating out the defending champion Las Vegas Aces, 35, and runner-up New York Liberty, 31. The Fever have the number one pick in Monday's WNBA draft, and it's widely expected the team will select Iowa star Caitlin Clark. Clark and her Iowa teammates have set TV audience numbers over the past two seasons, and their games have become appointment TV. The WNBA is banking on Clark's popularity to make the Fever a viewership draw. Indiana's season opener at the Connecticut Sun on May 14th will be aired nationally on ESPN2, while its home opener against the New York Liberty on May 16th will be on Prime Video. The Fever's two games on ABC this season will be at New York on May 18th and versus Seattle on August 18th. The two games on CBS will be versus Chicago on June 16th and versus New York on July 6th. The four games Indiana does not have on any national broadcast is at Seattle on May 22nd versus Atlanta on June 13th. Versus Atlanta on September 6th, 8th, and versus Dallas on September 15th.
Now it's time to turn to Dear Abby. New mother refuses to let her grandma hold the baby. Dear Abby, my oldest daughter Kate is 22. Her baby is now 6 months old. She is the first grandchild and great-grandchild. Kate refuses to allow my mom to hold her baby. My mom has held the baby a couple of times, but my daughter immediately swooped in and took the baby from her. During the last family gathering, Kate wouldn't let me hold the baby either because she said I might let my mom hold the baby. It hurts my heart to watch my mom treated this way. I know my mom. We haven't always been close, and sometimes mom says the wrong things, but she is a good person, and I would never hurt the baby. Because I let Kate know my feelings, she is now refusing to come to any family gathering where mom might be present, and she won't talk to me either. I'm struggling and emotional over this. Mom has done some very kind things for my daughter. She owns a timeshare and let Kate use it for graduation and her honeymoon. I feel Kate is using the baby as a weapon. Is there anything I can do? If not, how do I try to move on? Signed, Thwarted in Utah. Abby replies, Dear Thwarted, Kate may or may not be using her child as a weapon to punish you and your mother for some perceived slight. She may also legitimately be worried that her grandmother might accidentally drop the little one. You stated that you and your mother weren't close for a period of time. If you and your mother weren't close, it would follow that your daughter wouldn't be all that close to her grandmother. Of course, a solution to this problem won't be possible until you understand what has caused it, and that won't happen until your daughter is willing to give you some straight answers. Start there. If she refuses, you will have to live your life and hope that as your grandchild grows up, the dynamic will change. And our second letter to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, when a daughter is getting married, how do divorced parents sit, walk down the aisle, and conduct themselves? Signed, Almost There in New York. Abby replies, Dear Almost There, first and foremost, the divorced parents should act like adults and bury their hostilities, if there are any, on their daughter's special day. Tact and diplomacy should be paramount. Depending upon the circumstances, the person of choice should accompany the bride down the aisle. If there is a stepfather, some brides ask each gentleman to walk halfway down the aisle with her. If the parents are cordial, Emily Post says they can share the first row. If they aren't, and I am shortening this, the mother sits in the front row with her relatives behind her. The father and his relatives are seated behind his ex-wife's family. If the bride is estranged from her mother, the father and his family occupy the first rows. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Dave Buzik and Judith Linden. You can can listen to Irish programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.